From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've got a great show ahead for you today. We're going to be continuing our conversation about Medjugorje, those alleged apparitions starting in 1981 that were just approved or given the approval of the devotion, we should say, by the Vatican just recently. And the big focus on that approval was the fruits of Medjugorje, those positive things that have come from Medjugorje. We're talking about conversions and reversions and healing miracles and vocations and things of this sort. We see a huge number of those coming from Medjugorje. So many people that I have known and that I've met have found some kind of spiritual support from Medjugorje. And so this recognition by Rome recently was a big deal. And so we'll be talking today with Elizabeth Ficicelli, who's the author of a book called Fruits of Medjugorje. And we'll be talking about just exactly what those spiritual fruits are that have been lauded by the Vatican and given that caused them to render that a judgment of approval related to Medjugorje. So we'll be excited to talk to her and to keep this conversation going and to try to answer some of those difficult questions related to that approval. And what does it really mean for Catholics who have that devotion and want to visit Medjugorje? How have things exactly changed from before that announcement by Rome and after that announcement? So we'll be talking to Elizabeth later in the program. Later in the show, we'll be talking about Martyrs of the Eucharist, a new book out from Tan Books by Father Francis Sophie. This is a new book that looks at those people who have given up their lives, saints and otherwise, who have sacrificed their lives in defense of the Eucharist or to protect the Eucharist or in other moments of their life. So it's really a great book for this time of Eucharistic revival, where there's no better way sort of put a focus on the Eucharist and show the devotion of people throughout the centuries than when we talk about those people who have given up their own lives for the Eucharist. So we'll be excited to talk about Martyrs of the Eucharist later in this program. Every week in the program They Might Be Saints, I feature Americans on the path to sainthood. This week on Wednesday, the 23rd at 8 a.m. Central Time or 9 a.m. Eastern, we'll be looking at the life of Father Aloysius Schwartz. He's a canonization candidate who dedicated his life towards working for the poorest of the poor, establishing youth programs and funding religious orders that still serve his worldwide mission long after his death. And his story was one of the most meaningful for me personally, because I got to travel to Chalco in Mexico and see the incredible work of Father Al Schwartz as he built that Villa de las Niñas, the village or town for the young girls, you might say. It was something like 4,000 girls who lived there, and truly, truly amazing, the work of Father Aloysius Schwartz. And I know that he did in Korea, in Mexico, in the Philippines, and otherwise, these homes for the poorest of the poor children around the world. It was truly an eye-opening sight. So learn more about Father Al Schwartz if you tune in on Wednesday, October 23rd, at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. Find out the story of Venerable Father Aloysius Schwartz. And you can check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter. Vilnius is the new episode, and it's one of the very new episodes that's never been seen before. So I encourage you to check this one out. We've filmed many of these episodes that are running on EWTN, but this is a brand new one. I investigate the miraculous image of Our Lady of Mercy, and I visit the sites of St. Faustina's early life and the original Divine Mercy image, which is in Lithuania's capital city. So check this one out. This is a good one. Explore with the Miracle Hunter, Vilnius. And that'll be on Saturday, October 26th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That'll be the next episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the Might Be Saint of the Day. For this week, we've got Blessed Jerzy Popieluszko from Poland, who died in 1947 as a martyr. And the 365 Days with Mary Project on October 19th, we have the All-Hymned Mother icon. That's from Russia in the 19th century. And the question of the week maybe is the hardest question I've ever gotten. Where is the Holy Grail located? Nobody really knows, but I'll give it my best shot later in the program. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that writes in with the fastest with the correct answer. And last week we asked a question about, we were talking about doctors of the church, or we were actually talking about science and Catholicism. So this was the question: which saint from Germany was a doctor of the church, a musician, and a scientist? And of course that answer was Hildegard von Bingen. She was a writer so brilliant that she eventually was made a doctor of the church, and she lived from 1098 to 1179, and she was brilliant in just about every way, you might say, whether it related to music, to science, or to writing. She was truly a one-of-a-kind saint. That's Hildegard von Bingen as the answer for last week's question. So this week's question is, who was the earliest born saint to be canonized? Who lived in the United States or the territory that would become the United States. So we're looking for the earliest born American saint, and that's different from who was the first canonized American saint. So see if you can get that one, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Jason Gale about a brand new book from Tan Books, Martyrs of the Eucharist, those people who died giving up their faith in defense of the Eucharist. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot about this show, about on the show, about Eucharistic miracles and those great saints throughout history who have had a tremendous Eucharistic devotion, miraculous and otherwise. We see great moments in the lives of these saints. Perhaps the most remarkable of all these are the martyrs of the Eucharist. And of course, we're talking about those people throughout Christian history who have died for their belief in the Eucharist and in defense of the Eucharist. And in this time of Eucharistic revival in our Catholic Church here in the United States, this is the perfect time to talk about these people whose belief was so strong that they were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And we're so excited to look at a new book. It's called Martyrs of the Eucharist, Stories to Inspire Eucharistic Amazement. It's out from Tan Books. And the author is Father Francis Sophy. And we're so excited to be joined today by Jason Gale, the Vice President of Content and Production from Tan Books, to tell us about this brand new book. Welcome to the program today, Jason.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Mike.
This book is amazing, and I think one of the things that's so interesting, and we're talking to you as a member of Tan Books, the publishers of this book, because the author, Father Francis Sophy, has recently passed away. So this is a great legacy for him, this new book that's out from Tan. Tell us a little bit about, before we get rolling with the book, who was Father Francis and what motivated him to write this book?
Yeah, so as you said, Father Francis Sophy, he was a priest for the Archdiocese of Mobile, Alabama for 30 years. And towards the end of his life, he had a dream of becoming a Dominican. And so he became kind of that third order, or what's called a diocesan Dominican, since he was already a priest. But he served in a variety of positions there in Mobile. He studied at the Angelicum, which is probably where his love for Aquinas and the Dominicans came from. And he also studied at St. Charles Borromeo in Philadelphia as well. And he took the name, when he became a diocesan Dominican, of St. Vincent Ferrer, who was a renowned Dominican preacher and a miracle worker. And I think that kind of Dominican spirit comes through in this book. He has that zeal for souls, and something else for our listeners to think about as well when you're reading this book. And I think it's kind of an interesting perspective. Is Father Sophy wrote this book while he understood that he was close to death, that his death was imminent, and so. I think a lot of that also comes out in the book as well, of kind of that really encouraging Catholics to think about martyrdom, think about death, think about your devotion to the Eucharist, and really increase all of your devotion to God.
Yeah, amazing. The name of the book is Martyrs of the Eucharist, Stories to Inspire Eucharistic Amazement, and it's a brand new book out from Tan Books. And I really like this book. We have a huge number of saint stories. I mean, I think there are 29 stories, and I like how it's divided up. We see the division, those who died attending Mass, those who died celebrating Mass, those who risked their lives defending or protecting the Eucharist, and those whose deaths are connected to the Eucharist. Talk to us, who's your favorite of the saints' stories from those who risked their lives defending or protecting the Eucharist?
Yeah, so there's a number of stories in here that I had not heard before, and so that's one thing that I really enjoy about the book is it has, you know, a lot of saints and a lot of other people, especially in that section on those who risked their lives for the Eucharist, because they didn't necessarily die, but they were willing to put their life in the situation of martyrdom, and they came out alive. But one of my favorite sections is the last section, so other deaths connected with the Blessed Sacrament. And I love the story of St. Nicholas Owen, who was martyred during the penal years in England where it was illegal to be Catholic. And he was not a priest. He came from a devout family. Two of his brothers were priests. But he had an extraordinary skill of devising hiding places within people's homes to hide priests, to hide vestments, to hide vessels. And so, you know, I really see it as an amazing story of not just courage, but also the way that God uses our natural abilities for divine purposes. And he did so much that, as Father Sophie points out, many scholars give St. Nicholas of Owen kind of the high regard of saying, you know, perhaps no single person has contributed more to the preservation of the Catholic religion in England during these times than St. Nicholas of Owen. So, you know, above any priest, you know, when we talk about preserving Catholicism during periods of persecution, many times we think of priests and ordained and sisters and religious. But during this period, when we look at it, St. Nicholas of Owen did so much to help the preservation of Catholicism. So he would go and, you know, before he would build one of these priest holes in homes where they could hide priests and other people and stuff, he would attend Mass, offer his work to God, and he would then receive the Eucharist. Only then would he start to work, and he would only work at night, and he just had a skill of carpentry where he was able to build, you know, sometimes he would build like dummy hiding places so that when the priest hunters would come around, they would find the dummy place and be like, oh, okay, there's nobody here, and then there'd be a whole nother layer. Some of the hiding places would be, they would have staircases that would lead up or down an entire story so that the priest or whoever could escape into an alleyway or onto a rooftop, and, you know, multiple false walls, tunnels. I mean, he was just amazing. He never created one like the other so that if one was discovered, they couldn't establish a pattern. Finally, he was caught, and he was tortured. He was racked for days, but he never divulged where any of the priest holes he built were located. And he was canonized finally as one of the 40 martyrs of England and Wales in 1970. But just an amazing, you know, I think just an amazing story.
Wow, incredible. And this book is chock full of similar stories of martyrs of the Eucharist. We're talking today with Jason Gale from Tan Books about the brand new book, Martyrs of the Eucharist, from Father Francis Sophie. And we also have, as I mentioned, we have those people whose deaths are connected to the Eucharist. Talk to us a little bit about a favorite story from that group.
Yeah, so, you know, we have, the one that I just talked about, St. Nicholas of Owen, that's kind of that one, other deaths connected. Now, those who risked their lives, I think that was the one, I apologize, I believe that was the one that you had asked about. In that category, the ones who risk their lives, there's a story that Father Sophie puts in here that is from his own diocese, which I think is phenomenal. And it's the story of two firefighters, Leroy McAtee and Captain H.H. Buddy Edwards. And this happened in Mobile, Alabama in 1954. There was a huge fire at the local church, and the priest came out. They were able to get the priest out, and when they showed up, the priest told them that that the Eucharist was still in the tabernacle. Now, both firefighters, Leroy McAtee and Captain Buddy Edwards, both of them had been altar servers at this parish. And so they knew the layout. They knew where to go. And so they ran into the church. They had to go all the way back into the sacristy. So the church is on fire. It's totally engulfed in flames. They had to run to the sacristy to get the key, unlock the tabernacle, retrieve the Eucharist, and make it out. And they were able to do this. And had they been just mere seconds later, the entire church, the floor, everything would have collapsed down upon them. And so they were, the story of them successfully retrieving the Eucharist, they were willing to put their lives on the line and risk that kind of death just to save the Eucharist from fire. And it's just truly, truly amazing.
Yeah, this book is full of these stories. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the idea that people would be willing to risk their life for the belief in the Eucharist, or they're physically to preserve the Eucharist, is absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. In this era in our church where we see as few as 30% believing in the real presence. But this really can help urge us towards a deeper, more profound love of Jesus in the Eucharist, and ignite a firmer belief and devotion to the Blessed Sacrament. Talk about some of the early responses to this book, and perhaps your hope for connecting with young people and otherwise about the belief in the Eucharist.
Yeah, so I think that not just my hope, but Father Sophie's hope as well, is that Catholics begin to keep these two ideas together, martyrdom and devotion to the Eucharist. And one of the things he explains in the beginning is that what do these two things have in common? How do we understand both martyrdom and the Eucharist? And he says, well, there's a common thread of totality, that in the Eucharist, it's not just a sign, it's not just partly Christ, but it is Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. He is there. The totality of his sacrifice on the cross is present in the totality of the Eucharist. You know, in a similar fashion, the martyr makes the ultimate sacrifice back to God. And in this case, the stories we're looking at, they're martyred specifically for the Eucharist. And so, you know, when we encounter things like the most recent, kind of blasphemous actions by the governor of Michigan, How do we encounter that? Do we simply remain silent if somebody brings it up? Thankfully the bishops immediately put out a statement and said no, you can blast us all you want, but you do not blaspheme our Lord, and so Catholics have to be willing to stand up for that and say you don't blaspheme the Lord, you don't blaspheme the Eucharist, Our Lady. We hold these things to be holy, and we speak about them only when we speak in reverence. And so Catholics have to be willing to begin, if not already, to make that very, it's not easy. It's not easy, and it's one that requires grace. But if we want to be, we want to move towards a stronger devotion to Christ in the Eucharist, we have to be willing to give up more. We have to be willing to work towards that totality because God gave us that totality in himself in the Eucharist.
We encourage people to pick up this book, Martyrs of the Eucharist, Stories to Inspire Eucharistic Amazement from Tan Books. It's by Father Francis Sophie. Check that one out. You can go to tanbooks.com to find out more and to pick that one up. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting questions either through email or when I give talks. I've been giving talks around the country. I give as many as 20 per year. I go to Catholic parishes, shrines, or conferences. And I talk about miracles, of course, these days. I speak a lot about Eucharistic miracles because it's this time of Eucharistic revival in our church. And I always leave it open for questions at the end. And I get some really interesting ones. And but people also email me with questions as well. But for people who'd like me to speak at their parish or their event, you can contact me through the miraclehunter.com website. Click on the contact tab and send me a message that way. And so the question for this week is maybe the hardest question I've ever gotten, and perhaps I'd become rich if I really knew the real answer to this question. But the question is, Dear Miracle Hunter, where is the Holy Grail located? And that's coming to me from Kurt. Well, thanks, Kurt, for your question. And it's a good one. And of course, nobody really knows where the Holy Grail is. And of course, there have been books and movies and otherwise, and people dedicating their entire lives to the search for this impossible object to find. That is the cup of Christ used at the Last Supper, purportedly. That's the item, the Holy Grail, that everybody the world over has searched for. Some people have suggested that if you possess the Holy Grail, you'd have the power to command armies, for example. And of course, I'm referencing an Indiana Jones movie when I say that. But when we talk about where is the true Holy Grail, there are a couple of locations around the world, but perhaps there's one where we will do an episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter coming up sometime soon. The trip isn't scheduled yet, but it's on my radar at least. So in Valencia in Spain is a location where it is believed that there is a cup which is the true Holy Grail, or the true cup of Christ used in the Last Supper. And of course, there's no way to actually prove that that's the real one. And there are other ones that are in contention, perhaps, to be the true cup of Christ. But it's a great question, and one that I truly do not have the answer to. But if there is ever an answer to that one, trust me, that will be front page news, and it'll be reported on this show as well. So thank you, Kurt, for your great question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe we'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up to each date of the calendar year. You all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th, but believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year, and this lines up to things like feast days, the building of basilicas, the occurrence of great miracles. These are all the ways we celebrate the Mother of God all around the world. And so for today's date, October 19th, we have the All-Hymned Mother of God icon from Vladimir in Oblast in Russia from the 19th century. And the story goes that the icon O All-Hymned Mother derives its title from the 13th Kontakion of the Akathist to the Most Holy Theotokos. O All-Hymned Mother, who bore the word, holiest of all saints. The Mother of God wears a crown and clasps her child to her breast with both hands. Christ is held in the left arm and rests on her left shoulder. He is facing her, and both of his hands are placed below her neck. Instead of the usual stars on her head and shoulders, the faces of angels appear in three circles. This is similar to the Arabian icon, Store of the Mountain, not cut by hands icon, of the iconostasis of the Cathedral of the Transfiguration at Slavoki. And that is the All-Hymned Mother icon from Vladimir Oblast in Russia, from the 19th century. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to the website, 365 Days with Mary. You can pick up the book or download the free app from the iOS App Store, or you can join the Facebook page with 10,000 followers who like to see what the Marian devotion of the day is. So connect to the 365 Days with Mary project. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. We do this every week where we talk about a miracle from Christian history that lines up exactly to the day's date. And for today's date, October 19th, we've got an amazing miracle from the United States. John Birchman's a Jesuit. He was born on March 13th, 1599. He died on August 13th, 1621, was a Jesuit scholastic from Belgium, and he's a revered saint in our Catholic Church. At the time of Birchman's death, his heart was returned to his homeland in Belgium, where it was kept in a silver reliquary on a side altar of the church at Louvain. And Birchman's was declared blessed in 1865 and canonized in 1888. Statues frequently depict his hands clasped holding his crucifix, his book of rules, and his rosary. Now, the miracle that led to his canonization actually occurred here in the United States. It occurred at the Academy of the Sacred Heart at Grand Coteau in Louisiana. In the year 1866, 1 year after the Civil War, he appeared to novice Mary Wilson. Mary's health was poor, and her parents thought that the gentler climate of South Louisiana could be a remedy for her. And however, her health continued to decline to the point where for about 40 days, she had only been able to take liquids. But on October 19th, 1866, there's a quote, "Being unable to speak, I said in my heart, Lord, thou seest how I suffer. If it be for your honor and glory and the salvation of my soul, I ask through the intercession of Blessed Birchman's a little relief and health. Otherwise, give me patience to the end." End quote. She went on to describe how John Birchman's then appeared to her, and she was immediately healed. When the academy opened the boys' school in 2006, the trustees named it St. John Birchman's School, and it's the only shrine at the exact location of a confirmed miracle in the United States. This occurred on October 19th in 1866, today's date. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about people on the path to sainthood and the search for canonization miracles. And of course, we're talking about servants of God, venerables, and blesseds before they have all their miracles and are recognized as saints by Rome. And we look at people who are from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And of course, this connects to my television series, which airs on EWTN every Wednesday morning, and also my book, They Might Be Saints, which is, I think, my best book. It's available from EWTNRC.com. It's the story of 24 venerables and blesseds, those personal stories that give us insight into why these people are on the path to sainthood as venerables or blesseds, soon to be saints. And so for today's date, we'd like to keep you up to date on the sainthood news. And apparently World Mission Sunday is a popular day for a pope to canonize new saints, and not only those who ministered or gave up their lives in lands known as mission territories, but men and women from every walk of life from around the world. And so in 2024, this year, the celebration of World Mission Sunday on October 20th will be no different. Pope Francis is scheduled to declare new saints. Blessed Giuseppe Alemano, the founder of the Consolata Missionaries, 8 Franciscan friars, and 3 Maronite laymen who were martyred in Syria in 1860, Canadian-born Blessed Marie-Léonie Paredes, the father of the Little Sisters of the Holy Family, and Blessed Elena Guerra, an Italian nun who founded the Oblates of the Holy Spirit. So these are the 14 people who will be declared saints this year on October 20th. So that's the sainthood news that was just announced this past week. Let's take a look at the Might Be Saint of the Day. We do this every week where we talk about people on the path to sainthood. And we talk about who venerables or blesseds who have a feast day, death anniversary on the day's date. And so this is a saint who I know well. This is somebody who we went to his shrine on my past pilgrimage to Poland, Blessed Jerzy Popieluszko, who died in 1947 as a martyr in Poland. And his feast day is today, October 19th. He was born to a family in 1972 on May 28th in the Archdiocese of Warsaw in Poland. And he was a vocal anti-communist preacher during the period of communist rule in Poland, and he worked closely with the anti-communist Solidarity movement. And when martial law was declared in Poland to suppress opposition, the church continued to work against the communists, and Father Jerzy's sermons were broadcast on Radio Free Europe. And the secret police threatened and pressured him to stop, but he ignored them. They trumped up evidence and arrested him. But the church hierarchy indicated that they would fight the changes. The false charges were dropped. Father Jerzy was released and he continued his work and was pardoned in a general amnesty on July 22nd. The communists tried several times to kill him and make it look like an accident or anonymous attack, but they quit hiding their intentions, and the secret police simply kidnapped and killed Father Jerzy, and he is considered a martyr. And that was, he was born in September 1947. He was kidnapped and killed on October 19th, 1984, by the Secret Security Service of the Ministry of Internal Affairs in the Communist Polish Secret Police. He was beaten to death from October 19th to October 20th near Wrocław in Poland, and his body was dumped in the Vistula River Reservoir, where it was found on October 30th, 1984. The murderers and their supervisor, Gregor Petrovsky, and others were arrested, convicted of the crime, and received very light sentences. More than 250,000 people attended his funeral, and he was buried at St. Kostka's Church in Warsaw. And the rock that struck the killing blow is enshrined in the Basilica there in Italy, in St. Bartholomew's Basilica. And he's declared venerable on December 19th, 2009, by Pope Benedict XVI, where they declared his martyrdom, and also beatified on June 6, 2010, by Pope Benedict XVI. And this recognition was celebrated in Warsaw, presided by Archbishop Angelo Amato. And that is Blessed Jerzy Popieluszko, the blessed who is our might be saint of the day. And with one miracle, he will go from Blessed Jerzy to Saint Jerzy. And those people who like to keep up with the television series They Might Be Saints, it airs every week on Wednesday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And coming up on October 23rd, the episode is They Might Be Saints, Father Aloysius Schwartz. He's a canonization candidate who dedicated his life to working with the poorest of the poor, establishing young youth programs and founding religious orders that still serve the worldwide mission long after his death. In a truly incredible life, a truly incredible man, that's Father Aloysius Schwartz. Check that one out on EWTN on Wednesday, October 23rd at 8 a.m. Central Time, 9 a.m. Eastern. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Elizabeth Ficicelli about the fruits of Medjugorje. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. On recent programs, recent weeks, we've talked about the biggest miracle news there's been, perhaps, since the release of the Third Secret of Fatima. That, of course, was the statement from Rome, or the press conference, that acknowledged the apparition devotion related to those 1981 events that happened, as reported by six children in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the former Yugoslavia. Of course, we're talking about Medjugorje. And with their decision coming out on May 17th, there was a press conference. I was connected to that remotely as a journalist through EWTN. There was great interest worldwide in this because there had been no statement from Rome since 1981, since the onset of these events. So this was a big deal that we saw Rome acknowledging in some way these alleged apparitions that have been recognized as far as the spiritual fruits go of these events. And so we're excited today to talk to a frequent guest of this show, and that's Elizabeth Ficicelli. And she's the author of a book called Fruits of Medjugorje, Stories of True and Lasting Conversion. And of course, this is exactly what the Vatican was talking about when it gave its recognition and approval of the devotion. They talk about the spiritual fruits, the spiritual experience there in Medjugorje. And so this is a perfect book and a perfect person to talk to about this. Welcome back to the program today, Elizabeth.
Hi, Michael. It's always a joy to be here. And what happy news we have to celebrate in October, the month of Our Lady. We've been waiting for this a long time, haven't we?
This has been a long time coming, this decision from Rome, or at least some form of a decision. We've seen the local bishop there in Bosnia-Herzegovina give statements, not necessarily approving these apparitions, in fact, giving sort of a discouragement from this. We've seen this from local bishops. And in 1991, the Zadar Declaration coming out of the Yugoslavian Bishops' Commission, we see them sort of saying a maybe. It's a non constat statement, meaning that it's not established as supernatural. They don't know either way what it is or what it isn't. But right. The Vatican has stayed silent all these years.
When they changed the norms recently, and you mentioned this, Michael, I think that was a smart idea to take away that supernatural category, so to speak, because, you know, when you say supernatural, you're talking beyond normal, beyond natural. So we don't have devices, you know, machinery to measure such things. So really what the church has always done with these miraculous events or reports of miraculous events is look at the messages themselves, that they're in church, you know, conformity with church teaching. They look at the visionaries to see what their emotional and spiritual state of mind is. And of course, the big one is to look at the fruits. So they, you know, that they are giving Medjugorje now this Nihil Obstat, that is their highest ruling now that they are giving. And what they're basically saying is that nothing stands in the way about Medjugorje for the faithful to go there on pilgrimage, to read about it, to apply the messages to their lives. So this is wonderful news. I've been waiting so long, made my pilgrimage there way back in 1989, so in the early years, right before the war. And I know myself, I was hugely impacted. It would change my life forever. And I remember thinking back then, I can't possibly be the only person, and that's what would eventually get me to start collecting the stories. But as you said, the Vatican is looking at those fruits. They look at conversions and vocations and ministries and people returning to the sacraments, forming prayer groups. And so real changes in people's lives over these past 43 years. And they're not making specific ruling about, like, for instance, the visionaries themselves. And you know, I was surprised that because some of these children are still receiving messages, that they've at least moved forward. But this is a huge, huge thing. And I don't know if the whole world is grasping the importance of Medjugorje, such a long occurring set of apparitions and these messages that call us to put God at the center, to call us back to these five key elements: Eucharist, confession, prayer, fasting, scripture. You know, those are solid. I mean, if a priest recommends that to his parishioners, that's all good. That's going to lead you to a deeper life with Christ. So it is a joy for me to see this being approved at this level and for people to be able to go there and now speak freely about Medjugorje. Because as an author, speaker, and radio person, I've had to not be able to talk about it very much, you know, and just been waiting. And now the day has come.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Elizabeth Ficicelli about her book, Fruits of Medjugorje, as it relates to this brand new news coming out of Rome from this past month related to the approval of the devotion related to Our Lady of Medjugorje, Queen of Peace. And there has been the question that's been posited, which is, what is different before and after these apparitions? I think that perhaps we might say, what's very obvious is different, that Rome is finally acknowledging it in some way it never has before. And the local bishop perhaps is no longer antagonistic towards it, and now he's sort of encouraging the devotion himself, or opening that up in a way that's different than his predecessors, you might say. So that's very different from the experience of those people who have this devotion and want to travel there on pilgrimage. But prior to the announcement, pilgrims could go to Rome, they could go to Medjugorje, and you see that they created an apostolic visitor from Rome who was resident there in Medjugorje, and the Pope had sent messages himself to the large gatherings of faithful there, especially at the Youth Day. So, in your estimation, Elizabeth, what changed for believers before and after that big announcement from Rome?
I think the main difference is people can go on pilgrimage there with a open heart that they know they're doing something that the church is giving its approval on. And not only lay people can go, but priests can go, bishops and cardinals now can go. I don't know if the Pope will eventually himself plan a visit. That would be very interesting. But I think now that there's been so much controversy with Medjugorje in the past and false allegations against it and saying, oh, these messages are dividing people. And so it's been a long, tough road for believers in these apparitions to be patient and see kind of the vindication of this event. But now, you know, people can go. And I mean, it's millions and millions and millions have gone through the years. So I don't know if you'll see a sudden upsurge because you have the tremendous youth days there. You have just people coming from all over the world. But I think now people can go in true celebration that the church is now giving its green light, finally.
We're talking today with Elizabeth Ficicelli about the Fruits of Medjugorje, which is the name of her book, Fruits of Medjugorje, Stories of True and Lasting Conversion. Elizabeth, what inspired you? I think you you mentioned earlier in the interview you had gone to Medjugorje yourself and had your own experience, and you saw that other people had life-changing experiences at Medjugorje. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to put together this book.
All right. Well, as I said before, I came back so changed. I mean, we really took to heart these messages, and I started to go to Mass during the week. I went to monthly confession. We adapted the fasting practice at least one day a week, started diving into Scripture and increasing our prayer life, and I saw the fruits in my own life immediately. So I was already starting to write some Catholic books at the time, and I thought it would be really interesting to see how other people's lives have changed, like mine had. And so I put out a call to stories on the Internet. And the thing that was really striking in the stories that came in, it was a common theme from start to finish, was these were not just conversions of someone going to this place and coming back and just going to Mass more frequently. These were conversions that led these people to make life-changing decisions, like to be or a sister, for instance, because that obviously not only radically changes your own life, it's going to change all the people's lives that you will touch moving forward, and that's a lot of lives. So people who would start humanitarian efforts, prison ministries, homeless shelters, the list would go on and on, but it was so remarkable to me that these conversions would go so public, so viral, so to speak. And I put this book together, The Fruits of Medjugorje. It came out at first came out in 2006. And at that point, you know, the Vatican was already, as you said, had taken the authority away from the local bishop in Medjugorje and was already beginning to look at it themselves and form this commission. So I sent the book to Pope Benedict. I sent it to Rome, hoping that this would be an example. I chose specifically not to delve deep into the messages or into the lives of the visionaries. People had already written books on that, but simply to look at the fruits, these undeniable fruits. And I'd like to hope in some way that that book was sitting at a conference table over in Rome as they were looking at evidence for the apparitions that these are you know, you can't deny the fruits. And that's what the Vatican just said. It's really hard to deny the fruits.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I know I've mentioned to you before, I've seen your book at Lourdes when I've been there. So your books are everywhere around the world. So we're so grateful to you, Elizabeth Ficicelli, for joining us on today's show. And if people want to pick up this book, The Fruits of Medjugorje, Stories of True and Lasting Conversion from Elizabeth Ficicelli, where can they go to pick up this book?
Sure. I'd certainly direct them to my website, elizabethficicelli.com. But you can certainly get it on the internet and where you get your favorite Catholic books. But yeah, it's stories that are timeless. And just real quick, probably one of the most famous stories in the book is Father Donald Calloway. Mm. And a lot of people know him. He certainly has traveled around the world speaking and sharing his story. But the part of his story that he has not been able to talk about was the night he, as a very troubled 21-year-old, read a book on Medjugorje that was his mother's, that was sitting on the coffee table, and that was the moment that changed his life. And he has not been able to really talk about that because he was also patiently waiting for the church to make a ruling. So some exciting stories like that and more, and I hope people will be inspired to find out more about it and to go there if possible. It's an amazing gift from God.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Elizabeth Ficicelli, for joining us on today's program and talking to us about the fruits of Medjugorje, the title of your book, and a topic that has been much discussed recently coming out of the Vatican with that recent approval from Rome of the devotion related to Our Lady of Medjugorje. Thank you so much, Elizabeth, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael. God bless.
God bless. That was Elizabeth Ficicelli. Great interview talking to us about the fruits of Medjugorje. You can check her out, elizabethficicelli.com, for more information on her. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Jason Gale from Tan Books, talking to us about Martyrs of the Eucharist. And also Elizabeth Ficicelli talking to us about the fruits of Medjugorje. Check out my new program, Explore with the Miracle Hunter Vilnius, that airs on the 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be investigating the miraculous image of Our Lady of Mercy, and I visit the sites of St. Faustina's early life and an original Divine Mercy image in the Lithuanian capital city. Check that one out, Explore with the Miracle Hunter Vilnius. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.